Well, good morning, brethren and sisters and young people. The objects that God has in family life are very clear as they're outlined in the scriptures. We know that God says, "Lo, children are an heritage of Yahweh." I'd like you to start with me in Deuteronomy chapter 6 in a very well-known verse where we have our obligations toward our God in responding to his love outlined for us in the words that were given to Israel. And these are, in the words of Christ, the greatest commandments of all. Deuteronomy 6 and verse 4. "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord. And thou shalt love Yahweh thy God with all thine heart and with all thy soul and with all thy might." And that is the fitting response of every human creature to the love of God. But notice that God immediately links that response to family life. "And these words which I command thee this day shall be in thine heart, and thou shalt diligently teach them unto thy children, and shall talk with them when thou sittest in thine house, and when thou walkest by the way, and when thou liest down, and when thou risest up." And our response to God must immediately be linked to passing on the truth in our families. The greatest command is apply God's love and God's truth to yourself and then apply it in your family. And we want to speak today to every one of you because there's no one that's exempted from the principles of family life. Whether you're here as young people, therefore if time goes on, God willing, potential parents. To those of you who already have children, our parents, very much in need of scriptural advice as we were. As grandparents, we need to be able to give sound counsel to those who are younger than ourselves. And as a community, brethren and sisters, we do need a strong family culture that the truth might be passed on between the generations. And God intends both our ecclesial and family circles to be vehicles for his truth to continue. Look what it says in verse 7. "And thou shalt teach them diligently unto thy children." And the word "teach" there in the Hebrew means to sharpen. You see in the margin, if you have it, to whet or to sharpen. And that's the thing that God wants us to do with our children, to make them sharp arrows, that when they go forth into the world, they will fly straight and true, and that they'll have a point in their lives. "Thou shalt teach these things diligently unto thy children." To rub them until they are sharp. And the greatest and most effective method of proclaiming the truth has always been and will always be that we raise our families to be a godly seed. It's not saying that preaching work externally is not important, but the truth has always grown most from those children that God places in our care. In Psalm 78, I've got it on the overhead for you just to save time. Psalm 78, we have the words of God concerning his message for families. I wanted you to notice that families are not just given to us for our own pleasure, for us to have pride in our children and their achievements, nor to assure our security in old age. But the families that God gives us are his work that the truth might be continued. And he says there, "We will not hide these things from our children, but tell them to the generation coming that the glorious deeds of Yahweh and his might and the wonders that he has wrought, God established a testimony in Jacob and appointed a law in Israel which he commanded our fathers to teach their children, that the next generation might know them, and that the children yet unborn, they might arise and tell them to their children." And you get a very clear sense from Psalm 78 that God intends generation to follow generation, growing up very clear on the things of the truth. And God willing, this week we intend to look at the patriarchs as an example of the family life that God intended. When you look at the relationship between Abraham and Isaac, we have a very limited record that consists mostly of two incidents. These two incidents show the pattern of the 75 years that the two of them enjoyed together living in that land as strangers and pilgrims. We have Genesis 22 and Genesis 24, both of them extremely typical events of the relationship of God and his Son. We have in Genesis 22 the sacrifice of the beloved Son on Mount Moriah. In Genesis 24 we have the taking of a bride from afar for the Son of the Father. And in both incidents, Isaac prefigures the Lord Jesus Christ in full cooperation with his Father. And it's that cooperation upon which we wish to focus this morning, rather than the many lessons that are there in the types. Just think about what Isaac and Abraham portrayed in these two operations in Genesis 22 and 24, and particularly in the offering of that beloved son upon Mount Moriah. What an incredible thing that a mortal man and his son should be able to portray so long ago the great work of redemption that God would accomplish in his son. Abraham saw my day, said Jesus, and rejoiced to see it. To be able to see that great sacrifice with all its ramifications, that God would one day provide for himself a lamb for the redemption of the human race. And to know, as a father could only know, the pain of giving an only beloved son to die. On the part of Isaac, to submit to death in cooperation with his father, being prepared to die, to give his own life in obedience. And the outstanding feature of Genesis 22 we're going to see was the trust of Isaac in his father. That could only be the culmination of a wonderful relationship between those two that had developed over many years. So where did that start? Abraham and Sarah waited 25 long years for the birth of Isaac. From the time that God promised them a seed, that I will make thee fruitful, I will make thy seed as the stars of heaven, they waited 25 years for a child of their own, to have a son that they might give him back to God. You can imagine the care they put into the raising of Isaac when he eventually came. What is important is that before Isaac was even conceived, they had a very distinct family policy on what they wanted to accomplish with their children. Let that be a lesson to all of those young ones here amongst us, perhaps not yet married or newly married. You need to have a very strong conviction on what family policies you're going to apply when God, by his grace, might grant you children. You come to Genesis chapter 14 and see what Abraham had done for his family. We have in, go to Genesis 14, because we're there in a moment, but in Genesis chapter 18, you might remember the occasion when the angels came to Abraham to announce the impending birth of Isaac and to give them information concerning the destruction of Sodom. That the Yahweh angel who stood with Abraham debated in his own mind as to whether he would inform Abraham about the destruction of Sodom. And he said this, he said, "Shall I hide from Abraham that thing which I do?" The angels are using their initiative here. And he's got to decide whether it will be profitable to Abraham to know what's going to happen to Sodom. And because he knows that Abraham will use this wisely in his family, he does inform him of those things. But notice the view that the angels had concerning Abraham and his family policy. He says, "I know him, that he will command his children and his household after him." He did not have any children when that was spoken. The angels knew that Abraham had a family policy when as yet he had no children, except perhaps you might refer to Ishmael. "But I know he will command his children and his household after him, and they shall keep the way of Yahweh to do judgment and justice, that Yahweh might bring upon Abraham that which he has spoken of him. And if the promises are going to be fulfilled, it requires the parents to have a clear direction in their lives for their family. Now I want you to notice it does not say that Abraham would suggest to his children, that he would strongly advise his children or beg his children. It said he would command his children and his household to keep the way of Yahweh. And the angels are very pleased to work with those who have clear aims for their children and their family life. The servants had already responded. In Genesis 14, we find reference here to the household of Abraham's, particularly his servants. They were very numerous. And we find in Genesis 14, verse 14, when Abram heard that his brother Lot was taken, he armed his trained servants, born in his own house. Now that's a very unusual word. The word there, trained, means, as the margin says, instructed servants. The Hebrew word means to be narrow, to walk in a straight and a narrow path. These were servants that understood what Abraham was all about, what his pilgrim existence was all about. And we know the calibre of these servants. Come across to Genesis chapter 24. Very well known incident, Abraham's servant, Eliezer of Damascus, going on the journey to find a wife for Isaac, and he comes to the city in Padan Aram. And we notice that he was himself a man of prayer. Now remember, this is a servant in the house. I know him, he will command his house, the angel had said. And look at the quality of this servant. In Genesis 24 and verse 12, and he said, this is the servant, Eliezer, O Yahweh Elohim of my master Abraham, I pray thee, send me good speed this day and show kindness unto my master Abraham. Now there's a number of things we can draw from that. One, that he was also a man of prayer. He was a servant that had learnt from Abraham the value of prayer. He had learnt from Abraham to show faith in the goodness of God. We find out in verse 21 that he believed in providence. He was wondering whether Yahweh had made his journey prosperous or not. He was looking for signs that God was going to prosper the work. He loved his master. Look at the terms of verse 12. Showed kindness to my master Abraham. And there's no doubt that he had taken upon himself the faith of Abraham. Incredibly, in verse 26, when Rebekah comes forth to the well and gives her little speech about coming back to the house to stay, the man responds in the most unusual way. Now you think, if you were Rebekah and you've met somebody at the well, he's obviously a traveller, and he's asking who you are. If all of a sudden, in verse 26, he drops to the ground and starts praying. Now you would think this man's a bit strange. It said in verse 26, the man bowed his head and worshipped Yahweh, and he said, and he offers this prayer in public, Blessed be Yahweh, God of my master Abraham, who hath not left destitute my master of his mercy and his truth. There's a man who understands the God of Israel. I being in the way. And he means by that more than the fact that he's just come on a long journey. He was also in the way of truth. Yahweh led me to the house of my master's brethren. Notice again in verse 40. And he said unto me, Yahweh, before whom I walk, will send his angel with thee, and thou shalt prosper thy way. And this man realized that he was on the work of Abraham, and therefore he was in the way of truth. And we find again in verse 52 that when the servant of Abraham heard these words, again he worshipped Yahweh, bowing himself to the earth. What an incredible ambassador he was for the family of Abraham. You think about this, brethren and sisters. If you were Rebekah, a person turns up of whom you know almost nothing. He claims to be a servant of one of your relations. And he's asking you to leave home, to leave your family, and to go on a long journey from which Sarah never ever came back. She never saw her family again. To go and marry somebody you've never met. How many of the young girls here would take up that offer? But she went. Why did she go? Because she could see in that servant the quality of the father and son to whom she was joining herself. You see what it says over in verse 58. Genesis 24 and verse 58. And they called Rebekah and said unto her, "Wilt thou go with this man?" You see, they didn't ask her, "Will you go and marry this chap Isaac?" They said, "Will you go with this man?" Because everything that in her future depended upon what she saw in that man. And she had seen a man that dropped to the ground in prayer every time that he was grateful for the hand of providence. "Will you go with this man?" And again in verse 61, Rebekah arose and they rode upon the camels and followed the man, because he was an epitome of the house of Abraham. If servants had that kind of faith, if they had that kind of respect and love, you could be confident that the father and the son were worth knowing. Do you think she was surprised in verse 63 that her first sight of Isaac was to find him in the field meditating and praying? She wasn't surprised at all. You see, there was a family that was very much of the spirit of Abraham. And what does the first of Peter say about Abraham and Sarah? Yes, they were an example of husband and wife cooperating together, dwelling with them according to knowledge, the wife submitting as Sarah submitted in her heart to Abraham, calling him Lord in her heart. And what was the outcome of their cooperation? Their prayers were not hindered. That's the point that Peter makes in the first of Peter 3, isn't it, in verse 7. Their prayers were not hindered because they understood the principles of family life. And here was a family that was based around prayer. And we know that Abraham was very much a man of prayer. Look at what it says about Abraham and his prayers. He built an altar as soon as he came into the land. He called upon the name of Yahweh. In the incident with the king of Sodom, "I have lifted up my hand unto Yahweh. Oh, that Ishmael might live before thee." So Abraham prayed unto God. Abraham called there upon the name of Yahweh. And what do we find about Isaac? When his wife is barren, Isaac entreated Yahweh for his wife. And Rebekah also went and prayed unto Yahweh and said, "Why am I thus?" And Abraham and Sarah and their family were a family very much based upon prayer. And that was transmitted to their servants and to their children. That's why she was prepared to go with that man. "Wilt thou go with this man?" "Yes, I will go, because I can see that if the servants of the house are like this, how much better will the son be?" And so it was when she came to marry Isaac. And that's the first lesson that we must understand, is that the children will very largely be products of what they see the parents to be. Children are great imitators of parents. When they're young, they get their little hymn books and they sit in the lounge room and they play meetings because mum and dad go to the meetings. Your children will copy what you do far more than what you say. The greatest thing I learnt from my father wasn't so much the things that he taught me. It was the example of honesty that he gave me. I remember vividly as a young child, about 7 years of age, we filled up with gas, as you call it over here, at a petrol station, went some way down the road. And I remember my father turning around and going miles back to this service station because he realised that he'd been given too much change. And we as children were, "Why? But you spent more money on going back than you did give them back to the man." But that was just his honesty, and that to me was a tremendously impressive thing. Our children learn from what we do, from the little things they see about us, which indicate consistency. And the servants and Isaac all learned the value of prayer from Abraham and Sarah. Well, Abraham had very clear family principles And we have to have them likewise, brethren and sisters and young people. I want to just emphasise that point because we can't just let life happen to us. You know, we have so few years in which to educate our children in godly ways. When they're little, as parents, we're bursting to make them grow up. We force them to walk, we force them to read. We're always trying to make them advance in life. And when you get to about 13 and 14, you'd like to slow them down. Because those 10 years are the most difficult years. You know, somebody once said that it's a great misnomer to call our children teenagers. They really are parent ages. And that's what it's all about, those difficult years. When we go through those years when the children are flexing their own, finding themselves in life. And it's in those years you'd like to slow them down and to have your time over again. But if you haven't done the foundations when they're little, in those years when you've got them around your feet, when your word is gospel, if you don't use those years, then they'll slip by. And your children have got to know that there are family principles that you abide by. Well, let's look at Abraham's family principles. Now, you will get a copy of these overheads later in the week, so don't waste your time trying to write it all down now. Let's just follow through some of the things we know about Abraham. We're just going to take a broad view of his life, but there are the family principles of Abraham. And we want to bring them into the 21st century. They were firstly strangers and pilgrims on the earth. We know that from Hebrews 11 verse 13. That was the family policy. We are not like the Canaanites. We are waiting for the time when we will be granted the inheritance of Abraham. It tells in Hebrews 11 that he openly confessed. He declared plainly that they were strangers and pilgrims. He was promised that land but didn't own anything except a cave to bury his wife in. From the time that he came into the land and to the day that he died, he maintained both a physical and a moral separation from the Canaanites. Our children have to grow up with the indication that they are a different people from the rest of the world. It's all very comfortable to think that we can fit into society. But we have to give them the idea from early age that we are different. There are things that we stand for. There's a way of thinking, as our brother Jonathan said, which makes us different from everybody else. And our children need to understand that, that there's something different about them. Not as a matter of arrogance, as a matter of essential truth. Strangers and pilgrims in the earth. We've got to see that we're nothing more than passing through. They dwelt in tents, Abraham for 100 years, and Isaac lived in tents for 180 years. Some of us find it very hard to live in a tent for a week. You tried for 180 years. They could have had houses. When Jacob was east of Jordan, he lived in a house. But when they were in the land, they walked in tents. Why? To make a point to their children that we're only passing through in this life. Now, I'm not suggesting we all go and buy tents on the way home from the Bible school. What I'm saying is our children have got to understand that everything we own and everything we give ourselves to in this life is no more than survival. If they see you amassing wealth at the expense of dedication to the truth, then you're not living by the principles of Abraham. If they see work and job and money getting in the way and security in this life being more important than securing the kingdom, you're not living by the principles of Abraham. That was the meaning of living in tents. They were passing through in this life. There was the rejection of everything that this world stood for. Come to Genesis 14 and verse 17. You know this story. When Abraham came back from the rescue of Lot, King of Sodom comes out to meet him. And the king of Sodom is like most of our employers. He believes that we owe him something. And he's going to reward us, providing we give him due reverence. And in Genesis 14 and verse 17, it says, Abraham was coming back with the spoils, and the king of Sodom went out to meet him after his return from the slaughter of the kings of the north. And here's the king of Sodom coming out with all his importance and all his retinue. Abraham walked straight past him. And he walked straight down to talk to Melchizedek. And he snubs the king of Sodom dreadfully. And eventually after he's finished with Melchizedek, you can imagine the king of Sodom standing there, cooling his heels while Abraham has a memorial meeting with Melchizedek, and then he comes back and he says, you wanted me. And in verse 21, here's the policy of the king of Sodom, and I want everyone here to notice this. The king of Sodom says in verse 21, give me your soul, and I will give you all the goods that you want. He says, I want the souls, and I'll reward you. You can have all the spoil, but I want your souls. And the king of Sodom, brethren and sisters, is still around today. There are many employers out there that have got the policy of the king of Sodom. I want your souls. And Abraham said to the king of Sodom, I have lifted up my hand. You know, before he went to battle, he knew that if he was victorious, there would be much spoil that would come from this battle. He knew that he would have the king of Sodom wanting to reward him. He said, even before I went into battle, I made this promise that I will not take from you a thread or a shoelace. And they are the two smallest items of both male and female apparel. The thread means a ribbon, and the shoelace is a shoelace. I would not take a thread or a ribbon or a shoelace from you, lest you say, I've made Abraham rich. I refuse to be in the obligation of the king of Sodom. A very telling incident. We have to be prepared to make our priorities in this life known to all. Yes, we will work for our living. Yes, we will happily be diligent servants. But the souls of our families are our own. And if it becomes a matter between selling our souls to Sodom, then we've promised to God that we won't do it. The fourth thing about Abraham's family principles was his refusal to consider the old way of life. It says in Hebrews 11 verse 15, they had plenty of opportunity to go back to Ur. Brethren and sisters, if you've come in from outside, or even if you've had a checkered growing up in the truth, don't revel in your wasted years. One of the worst things you can do for your children is to say, oh, when I was in the world I used to do this, and we used to have a great time going to the motor sports or playing sport here or there. Don't revel in your lost past. Your children are listening to you when you do that, saying, he'd really like to be there. And I've heard people do this. Talk on and on about the things they did back in the world, and their children are picking up the signals, he'd really like to be there. Don't revel in the past. There's absolutely no profit in thinking about what life was like in Ur. They would have had opportunity to have returned, it says in the scriptures. And don't expose your children to the world any more than you need to. Abraham was insistent that when Isaac needed a wife, that Isaac was not to go back to look. Now that's rather incredible. I think perhaps most of our current generation of young people would find that almost impossible, to think that a wife would be chosen for you by somebody else. But you see, Abraham didn't want Isaac going back to Ur. The greater danger was not that a good wife would not be found,